Hello, and thank you for downloading this Conversations podcast. If you don't already subscribe, you can do it completely free of charge. It's easy. Details are on our website, abc.net.au/conversations, or just look for Conversations with Richard Feidler through iTunes.
Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio.
Hello and welcome to Conversations. If you've ever had a serious anxiety attack, you'll recognise these symptoms. Shortness of breath, heart palpitations, a creepy sense of vertigo or dizziness, horrible sweaty palms, and even loss of control of your bodily functions, which, as you might imagine, can only make the distress and horror of the situation much worse. And over the top of it all, a great flooding and rising sense of panic. Annie Roos is here. She's my guest today. Annie is actually a newly minted radio producer. She works with a commercial radio station, which has kindly given her leave to be on the program today. Some years ago, Annie Roos began to get panic attacks in the car on the way to work. And they were almost impossible for her to manage for a while, and she paid a high price for these attacks. But they got her thinking a bit more about the unusual circumstances of her childhood. On top of her broadcasting work, Annie Roos writes a popular blog that's called Life and Dandelions. Hello, Annie.
Hi, Richard. How are you?
I'm well. You know, I used to get anxiety attacks. They never kind of broke out. Like, yeah. I never kind of did that thing running up and down like Marge Simpson on the plane. But I used to get them flying, and it was because I was travelling on small aircraft. And I just woke up this one. Oh, not wake up. I was on a small plane once, one of those tiny little Cessna things, and realised there was nothing underneath me. And it was an exhausting ordeal for an hour and a half to try and suppress that rising sense of panic.
It's very exhausting. It actually just totally invades your entire mind.
Yeah.
There's no escaping from it.
That's right. That's why I described it as flooding. It floods, and it's rising and rising, and it feels like it's spilling over all the time all the way down to your fingertips.
And it's exhausting trying to push it away and trying to stop it. Mentally exhausting.
And the only thing that I think stops me from doing it is the sense of how weird I'm looking, you know, how weird it is. And I'm there sort of white-knuckled holding onto the seat rests on the plane going, I can still fly. The bigger the plane, the better for some reason. I don't know why, but a small plane really still troubles me today. So I empathise. You wrote about this on your blog.
I did.
And what kind of response did it get?
It was amazing. I had so many people write to me. My email address is actually on my blog, and they wrote me letters on emails telling me how, wow, you know, I felt the same way. And one man particularly described every feeling that I had in his email to me that I had gone through then, and he's only just recently gone through it. And it was quite amazing to read that, because normally you read about panic attacks and it's the palpitating heart and I'm going to have a heart attack. I didn't have it like that. It was more my insides were melting away.
And
he had exactly the same thing. And so, yeah, it was amazing. Just so many people out there are suffering from anxiety, and they don't say anything about it because it's, no one really understands, because it is a little bit weird.
The feeling you get sometimes, and I hope this makes sense to you, it's this kind of like logarithmic growth. It's this sense of something's doubling, and it's doubled again, and doubled again, and it's going to keep on growing exponentially up this chart, and it's until you don't know what the until is either.
Yeah, and anxiety's like that. It just sort of snowballs. It's like a big, it creeps up on you. So you might have one little, oh, that was a little bit anxious, but then the same thing happens again with the same type of thing, and you think, oh, actually that was a bit more, and then you start dreading that thing again, and all of a sudden you've got full-blown anxiety happening.
Can I tell you how I manage it on flying now? It's by holding a rictus grin on my face. It's like this stupid smile. I'm fine on the plane until I hit bad turbulence. Then I'm going to have this stupid grin on my face. And I'm sure anyone looking at the time would think I'm psychotic, because I look like Heath Ledger as the Joker. And that's what works for me. That's all I can say.
Yeah.
Do you manage it? Tell me how you manage it when you feel it rising.
It's hard. It's hard. I haven't had it really rise and take over me for a little while now. If I'm with my fiancé, it's okay, because he gets it and I can just say I'm really not feeling right, and I know he'll be doing whatever he can to find me the nearest toilet, and I'm okay, I can come. If I'm by myself, it's also not too bad because I know I'm not going to be embarrassed because I'm on my own. But if I'm with people I don't know, and actually I did have one recently, I was in Melbourne, and it wasn't a full-blown one, but I was in a car with a friend and she was driving me back to my hotel, and all of a sudden I started getting, my palms start to get wet, so I kind of feel like I could squirt water out of them almost. I get so...
Like Spider Woman.
Yeah, I feel that. Right. And I started feeling that, and then I started feeling a bit tingly, and I'm thinking, okay, I don't quite know what I'm going to do here. So I started breathing, and once upon a time I couldn't do that. I couldn't calm myself down. Once I got to the tingly stage, it was all over. But since some hypnosis I had a while back, I can actually bring
manage
myself back. Yeah.
What self-hypnosis, you mean?
I went along and saw somebody, right. And then that involved listening to some CDs at night as well. And haven't done it in a while, but it taught me something. I don't know, subconsciously, I never actually ever heard what he said on the CD.
Oh, I'll come to that again a bit later. But do your friends know this about you? And do you... If you're feeling this way and you're in a car with a friend, you then have to say, have a little speech. You don't know this about me, but I get anxiety attacks when I'm in a car and I think I'm about to have one. Or do they understand that, know that about you already?
Well, this particular person was someone I met through Twitter, and I had met her for the first time. So she knows about me, but I didn't really want to have a panic attack in her car in front of her children. So it was one of those things that I would deal with it myself unless it kind of went further. But my friends all know, and... Yeah.
So they know this could happen then if you're in the car with them.
Yeah.
What did it take for you to get here today?
Well, I've been very nervous.
Yeah, I know. You tweeted about it last night.
I know. I was very nervous. I had breakfast at 5 o'clock this morning so that I could be safely assured there weren't too many contents in my stomach that were going to upset my stomach. And I've had a couple of almonds since because I was hungry, but I don't eat anything that might upset my stomach. I take some Imodium.
To keep it all still.
And I just make sure I've got enough time to be ready. And
is there a ritual you follow? Is there a kind of a lucky ritual?
Yeah. It's that I don't eat. I have to eat before a certain time, and then I have to sort of go to the toilet X amount of times before I leave the house. And yep.
So you're really looking forward to this interview being over right now, so you can get a proper feed.
Okay, once I'm here. Yeah, I'm a bit hungry.
To understand it, I think it helps to take your whole life story into account. Let's start with you were an adopted child.
Yep.
Did you grow up knowing that?
Yep. Yeah, we were told, my sister was adopted also, so we were told when we were, well, I think I was about 4 or 5, we were given a book. It was a red book and it had ABC blocks on the cover, and it was all about how we were special. We were more special than other children because our parents got to go and pick us from all these babies lying in the cribs. We were the special ones because we were picked out. So I always had that concept of it from when I was quite little. So I never knew any different.
So that was a kindness in that sense. But how close were you as a family with your adopted parents?
Not. It was a strange family. They ended up having their own daughter a few years later. So there was three girls. I wasn't close to my sister. My mother wasn't demonstrative with her love or anything. And I think that was fairly common of that time. Mothers didn't tend to say, I love you a lot. And my father, well...
Yeah. Before we talk a bit more about him, what was he like as a person, your father? Can you paint a picture of him?
Look, he was...
He'd had an injury, hadn't he?
He did. He'd had an accident. So he had a brain injury that at times he would sort of, if he didn't take his medication, he would space out and wouldn't know anybody and just wander off. And that happened on and off, not a lot. He was quite smart in that he was very creative. He could draw. He was very great at calligraphy and ticket writing, I think it was called back then. So, and I used to be really, I loved all that stuff that he did. He was a beautiful writer. And he was very smart, but the accident, I think, had limited him. He wasn't a scary man. He was a quiet sort of man, but quietly creepy, I suppose, is the word.
Yeah. Your grandmother came to stay for long periods.
Yeah,
family.
She would come and stay, and I would have to sleep out in the lounge room on a camp bed.
And what came from that?
I can't tell you when it started, but basically he's a pedophile. So
he abused you?
Yeah.
How old were you at the time, Annie?
I think I was around... I don't know. I think around 5, 6, 7. I know I was older than four because we'd moved into a house when I was four. And I don't remember it happening in the other place. And I don't know whether that's because I was too young to remember. But I do remember, So he used to come into my room as well when my grandmother wasn't there as well. So he always did things to me when I was asleep, though. So
did he wake you up?
Well, I would wake up, but when you're little and a man's sort of touching you and doing things with his, you know, what do you do? As a 6-year-old, I was too scared to wake up and say anything or do anything, so I would pretend to be asleep.
So did he tell you not to tell anyone?
He didn't know that I knew, because I was always pretending to be asleep. So, yeah, so it was so... I think my anxiety started back then because I lived in a heightened sense of anxiety, scared about him coming into my room at night. So I started setting up traps in my bedroom, setting up things near the door. So if he was to come into my room, he would open the door and things would fall over and make a noise and I'd be able to wake up before he came in and he would go away. So if he came in and I was asleep, he would touch me and make me touch him, sort of just do things. But... yeah.
Were you able to escape out of yourself? You know, that's one way I hear some people in these situations do.
I'm guessing I did because I think I was relatively normal. I had really good friendships. I had a friend where I would spend a lot of my time with her family. I think I was relatively normal. He did stop after a while with me because... he couldn't get into my room, or I would stay awake. I would just stay awake until midnight. So every time he opened my door, I'd say, "Oh, what do you want?"
It's so got touches of, you know, Nightmare on Elm Street about it. You know, were you afraid to go to sleep?
Yeah, I did suffer a lot from not sleeping well as a result. But he did move on to my sister. She, I don't think, fared so well. She wasn't. She was pretty messed up, I think, throughout all of our childhood. I must have just turned off because I was like, well, okay, he's not bothering me. I didn't actually think, oh, perhaps he's touching her. I think I must have just shut it down.
Maybe at some point you think, well, I'm safe now and I don't want to think any more about that. You know,
and I think that's I think that's the case. It's really hard to go back and really think exactly what my thought patterns were back then.
I suppose that's what happens. You have to go back and reconstruct what happened from what these awful impressions that are going on. Do you think your adoptive mother was aware of what was happening?
I didn't know. I didn't think a lot about that because in my mind, he never knew I knew because I was always pretending to be asleep. So how could I tell anybody? And that was sort of how I had dealt with it. So I didn't really think beyond what she thought. But years later, when my sister did let me know that it was happening to her, she had told me that she had spoken to her about it, but nothing had ever been said. So, I'm guessing she might have had an idea. I don't know. Like, it's one of those things. It was common back then for wives to just...
don't talk about it.
Yeah, ignore things. Life was very different.
How did you process all this as you got older? There's not any one day you wake up and you go, oh, my God, I remember this.
It would come back at different times. So a bit later, as I got a bit older, it would come back and I'd sort of push it away again. My sister got pregnant when she was 16 and had a baby. And for quite a long periods of time, she would leave that baby and that little, as she grew into a little girl with them. So I often would think, oh, it mustn't have happened to her because she's left her child there. And I just kind of got on with my life, but it wasn't until I was sort of ready to have kids and it all would come back. I'd wake up some nights and I couldn't sleep because I'd be thinking about that and that I didn't really want him in my life when I had kids. And so, it would just come back at different times. I could go for years without even thinking about it.
It'd be very reasonable to come up with, imagine up elaborate revenge fantasies. Did you ever do that as a kid?
No, I don't. I'm not a revengeful sort of person. And I seriously think I didn't think a lot about it because it was too awful to think about. I mean, even the other night I was thinking about this interview and I was lying there, and if I lie there and really let myself think about it, I can feel and see things from when I was little, and I don't like that feeling, so I really shut them down really quickly. Because there are a couple of images that I just stay with me, and I just, yeah.
Don't need them.
No.
Don't need to dwell on them.
No. No.
Broadcaster and blogger Annie Roos is my guest in conversation today. When did you said your sister was being abused as well. When did you actually find out that that was going on?
It was Mother's Day, and my youngest was about 6 months old. So he's now 17, so 16 and a half years ago. Yeah.
What were the circumstances?
Well, I got a phone call from her, and she used to drink a lot. She would drink and do drugs, and she hasn't had a happy life, and I feel quite sad for her. But she rang me, and she was a bit drunk, and you know, we never had a close relationship, but she'd ring every so often, and I don't even know how it came about, but she just said something about our father or something, and I sort of said, "What did you say?" And she said, "Oh, you know, he used to abuse me." And I went, "Really?" And I said, "Oh, you know, he used to abuse me as well." And she said, "Really?" So she had no idea. And why she was so crazy was, as well, she hated me because she thought he was only touching her. So it was quite a strange childhood. But, yeah, she was sort of, she was really badly affected by him.
Isn't that terrible how resentment gets misdirected like that?
Yeah, know? And it was hard growing up because she used to really do some awful things to me, and which was another reason to spend more time at my friend's house. So, it wasn't a great upbringing. But, you know, I still look back on my childhood with fondness because I did have some great times. You know, I had great friends. I heard a song yesterday, the Rolf Harris song, Two Little Boys, and that just takes me back there. And I don't go back there and feel bad. I go back there and I still have good childhood feelings, because no matter how bad it is, you're still a child and you always find good in things.
That's right. Isn't that amazing?
Yeah.
Isn't that extraordinary? It's not ever any one thing, is it?
No.
It's
childhood is made up of hundreds and hundreds of things. So, you know, 20 of them might be bad, but 80 of them are still good.
What happened to your father?
Well, he's dead now. He had a history, apparently. All of this came out later after I did talk to my sister and we found out that we both shared this same thing. Firstly, I said to her, what about your daughter? You used to leave her there. And she said, "Oh, no, he didn't touch her." And I said, "But you didn't think he touched me." So she went back and turns out that he did touch her daughter. So that prompted her to actually have him charged. So they went along that path. She did ask me to be a part of it. I didn't want to. I had small children. I dealt with it. I wasn't bitter or angry. He hadn't hurt my children. It was only me. So I didn't have that sort of, I guess, axe to grind that she had. They had enough with the two of them. So he ended up getting charged, but I think he died before. He was quite old. He was living up on Bribie Island, and he was quite old by then. I think by then he was living on the street or somewhere. I don't know. I know that our mother had kicked him out at some point.
What's often terrible about pedophiles is that they don't experience shame for what they've done. Many of them. There's not a lot of shame sometimes.
No. Well,
they think they're victims of sexual hypocrisy or something.
I don't know what they think. I suppose one of my legacies from it is I really detest pedophiles. I have no tolerance whatsoever. I just think it's wrong. I just think it's wrong that people can do that to small children. It's everywhere, every way of wrong. You can't justify it in any way, shape or form. So he used to also work as a wardsman in the hospital in the town that I grew up in. And I didn't know this at the time, but he got fired from there, and it was because he was interfering with the patients, were the words that were. Yeah, so.
How about your mother in all this? Did you sustain, once you left home, do you have any kind of relationship with your adoptive mother?
No, I did. I never was close. I blocked. There was a distance, and it was never going to be anything close. But I kept in touch with them. They moved up to Queensland, so they would come and visit. And I did have children, and they did come and visit. And I never let the kids out of my sight when he was there. But when I found out that he'd done it to my sister and that she'd told our mother, and whether our mother had tried to do anything or not, for me that was the point where, you know what, I really don't want these people in my life at all. And I said to her, please tell them to never contact me again.
You left home at 18.
Yep.
How were your relationships, your first relationships out of that? That'd be complicated, wouldn't it?
With boys. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I left with a boyfriend who, you know, he wasn't the greatest. I guess my... He liked me, so that was good enough. I liked him. And, I went to Sydney with him, and it was okay. But when I decided he wasn't okay, he turned quite violent when I wanted to leave him. So,
Did you have a few relationships like that, or
Yeah, probably. And the next one were quite.
Was that because you were picking them, or were they sensing your vulnerability or something, and they picked you? What do you think?
I don't know. And maybe, you know, maybe there are guys out there that do sense that. My criteria back then was, oh, he likes me, so, you know, he must be good enough. Because I think I had that, you know, not quite worthy of being liked by anyone good. So, yeah.
Annie Roos is my guest. She's a radio producer and a blogger, and her blog is called Life and Dandelions, which I love the title as well. There's a bit of irony in the title of that.
I thought hard about that title, actually.
So after a while, though, you did find someone. You got married, and you got a job and had some children, yep. As you say. When did you start getting panic attacks? How long ago was this?
I think I'd had a couple... Before we got married, I think I'd had a couple that I didn't quite know what to put them down to. They were just random one-off type things.
Like would happen to anyone, I suppose. You know, the one-off thing you get every once in a while.
Yeah. And then it was after I had the children, it was quite hard. I had some postnatal depression, which I didn't get diagnosed, and I had glandular fever, and I had two small children. And I think mentally I was just quite fatigued, and plus we'd had all this other stuff going on with my father and whatnot. So I think from that point I started to really just get really worn down.
Tell me what happened the first time you had a...
Okay, well we were driving to work. I worked part-time in the city, so we were driving into work, and everything was okay, and then all of a sudden just didn't feel quite right, and I just had this... case of diarrhea. I just had to get to a toilet. We're in peak hour traffic, not a lot of toilets around. We'd just gotten up near the Normanby Fiveways, and there was a chicken factory farm. I can't remember what it is now, but it had, I think it was Sunny Queen Eggs or somewhere, it was somewhere near there. And I just said, I've got to get out of the car, I've got to find a toilet. So I jumped out of the car, ran over to this place, buzzed on the buzzer, and the lady let me in. I was like, please, can I use your toilet? And I just made it. And I kind of didn't think too much of it. I got back in the car and thought that was pretty awful, but maybe I ate something or whatever.
You're out of the car, essentially, you'd been able to go to the toilet, you felt better then?
I was fine. It was gone. It was.
Gone completely.
Yeah. I had that sense of, whew, that was a bit close, but then...
That's a major arterial road, that one as well. Like,
yeah,
you would have had to leg it across, what, six lanes of traffic or something.
Well, and we'd come from Kalanga, so it was quite a long trip in. And I was really, by that point, I would have climbed over the car bonnets like in the movies. I would have done anything to get to where I had to get.
but the thing is, you say once it's over, it's gone completely.
It's gone, and I was fine. I was a little bit...
What was that about?
A little bit shaky, but okay. But
were you doing anything different that day? Do you think? Can you think of anything specific about that day that might have brought that on, or something you saw? I mean,
nothing that I can put my finger on, or could put my finger on then. And then the next time we got into the car, because I only worked the 2 days a week, so that was the Friday. The Thursday when we got back in the car again to do it, same thing happened. Same place.
Same knock on the door.
So, no, I didn't stop there, but at the same place it started last time, it started again. So then it was that fight with myself that, you know, no, you'll be okay. No, you won't. Yes, you will. No, it, all the way. And then we went past the place. I thought, no, I can do it. And then as soon as we went past it, I started melting down again, thinking, oh, my God, what am I going to do now? And we remembered, well, I remembered there was someone we knew that lived close by, so we quickly took a detour to their place. And
knocked on the door again.
Knocked on the door again.
Made that speech again.
Someone was actually in the bathroom and I had to throw them out. And
I should laugh. But
it, well, it is.
There's some black humour in all this, isn't there?
There is.
Oh, dear. And then explain yourself too. Were you mortified after that too?
That one really made me think something's not quite right here. And that stayed with me and I was quite shaky after that, just thinking, oh, is this going to happen again? And then it's, this is how anxiety starts. Something like that happens. So then it's like, okay, I don't want that to happen again. So the next time I'm going to work, I get up and I go to the toilet and I go to the toilet and I go to the toilet and, you know, I better take something. And
then you're getting anxious about the impending anxiety.
Yeah, so it's a vicious cycle.
You're listening to Conversations with Richard Feidler on ABC Local Radio. Broadcast, podcast, and online.
Today my guest is radio producer and blogger Annie Ruse. She's here at the moment talking about anxiety attacks, which many, many people, including me, suffer from time to time. Annie's had a period where she's had them very, very powerfully in her life. And Annie, before you were telling me how you had the first one, then the second one, exactly the same place. You're in a car, in a small, enclosed space. It's very hard to get out of it when you're driving. You think that had something to do with it?
Yeah. Do you know what? For me, it's about being in a place where I have no control of my exit. So, because mine manifests in a way that it's, I have to go to the toilet. My stomach contents will literally melt and, you know, it's like I've got food poisoning and I've got to get to a toilet as soon as possible.
What do you know about that? Is that some reaction to the fight or flight response?
Yes.
The brain?
Because that's what animals do. Birds,
they avoid themselves.
Birds particularly, so they can, you know, be as light as possible and fly or run or whatever. So that's how it manifests in me. It's different for different people, but for me that was always that's my weak point, I guess.
So you got this vestigial caveman thing, or we all do, I suppose, this vestigial caveman thing, which might have been fine in the forest 100,000 years ago, but in peak hour traffic,
it's not real good.
And it's not real good.
There's not a lot of bears or lions chasing me there as well. So it's quite, there's nothing scaring me. That's the whole silly thing about it. When I'm driving in my car, I'm not scared. I'm not scared of anything. I'm not going. Most of the times, I wasn't even going to things that were scary. It was just normal day-to-day activity. Taking the kids to school, or the older one, to school. One day, I must have gotten in and out of the car 17 times on the driveway because I've got to go to the toilet again. I've got to go again. I've got to go again. I couldn't get, you know, the school was 5 minutes away.
Aside from all the anxiety, it's also, of course, you know, embarrassing as well. So did you keep it a secret? And were you even able to?
Pretty much. Like I really only had one time where I embarrassed myself, but I was alone. So that was okay. I just planned. I lost a lot of weight because I, you know, if you're going somewhere, I don't eat, I can't eat that. I was really, it was just high stress, that constant, the feeling you said you had in the plane where it's all you can do to sort of
manage it.
Yeah,
hold it down.
I was living in that state almost continually for quite some time. It didn't go away. When I wasn't in the car, I was thinking about when I was going to be in the car. And when I was in the car, I was looking at every house and thinking, I wonder if I could knock on their door, or I wonder, you know. And at one point, I took shopping bags in the car. So if I had to pull into a side street, I had, you know, it was horrible. It was a really...
Here's another thing about anxiety attacks. People aren't real patient with others, with people who have them, because they find it disgusting or embarrassing.
And it does take a lot of time. I know after I'd had the actual real life disaster that I thought would never happen, and it happened, that was sort of for me the tipping point. I went to my doctor and I you know, I was just a mess. And she said, look, I think we're going to have to put you onto something, some antidepressants. I didn't want to do that. So,
sorry, how long did it take for you? You said you had an accident, that's why you had to go to the doctor. How long did you wait, though, before that happened?
It was months. Because
you were going for months?
It wasn't always. It escalated. So it started off every time I just got in the car to go to work. Other trips were fine. Then it started happening for other trips, and it kind of started lightly and then just escalated. So by the time I did actually have that issue, it was every single time I got into the car. So it was unmanageable. And
what were you telling yourself? You were telling yourself, oh, this is nonsense, I can manage.
Yeah, I was mentally trying to, you know.
Pull your socks up, girl, that
yeah.
kind of thing.
Yeah, and I was getting a bit of that as well from people who knew me. So it was like, come on, you can do it. Don't worry about it. You know, it's all in your mind. And it is all in my mind. Anxiety is all in your mind, but it manifests physically. So it's a really hard thing, because it actually is, your mind can control it, but also your mind can make it out of control.
Yeah, I mean, it's all very well to have someone shouting at you to practice a bit of self-mastery.
Yeah.
When it's the loss of that is why you're panicking.
Yeah, it's really, it's very hard to explain. My fiance is really good. He likes to be on time all the time. And when I was still having these issues a couple of years ago, I always had to factor in toilet time. So I would factor in toilet time before we left home and toilet time en route. So there was always that sort of buffer of, if we have to stop, we can. So I don't actually have that toilet time factored in anymore, because I'm at the moment going really well. I'm
managing
okay.
It. At the worst of it, how often were these happening? How often these attacks?
Whenever I got in the car.
Every day.
Whenever we were going somewhere, yeah. So when they're bad, it's every time I have to get in the car.
What did the doctor suggest once you finally saw a doctor?
I didn't get them from my doctor. I went back home that day after the accident, and I think I just had a meltdown. The next day I woke up with this black cloud just sitting over my head. It was like I couldn't do anything. I couldn't escape myself. I wanted to literally scrape my brains out and just get away from it for a minute, and I couldn't. Like, you know, if you've got a broken arm, it hurts, but you've still got, your mind can think about other things. Mental illness is so all-encompassing that you actually can't escape it. And I got a sense of that this particular day, how people must feel with other mental illnesses. So, that weekend was terrible. On the Monday, I couldn't take my son to school, and my mother-in-law took me to the doctor, and he put me on some fairly heavy-duty antidepressants that they use to treat anxiety. They were... Going on them was awful. The side effects are quite scary when you start taking them.
Psychological or physiological?
Both. Just that they're very strong, and they make you feel even worse, but you've got to apparently push through that. Then I did start to feel better, and I did get better, and I did feel better from the anxiety attacks, but I didn't really like feeling numb. Not numb. You actually don't feel depths of emotion, so you're kind of even.
Were you looking all over the internet at this stage,
trying
to find more about what you had?
It's funny that you say that, because the internet was just kind of coming in. We didn't have it, and our neighbour was a computer expert. So that week I went over and asked if I could borrow his internet, if I could sit on there for a while. And the first thing I ever looked up on the internet was Arapax, and that was the tablets that the doctor had put me on. So that was my first ever search on the internet.
And just your anxiety medication.
Yeah, and I spent about 5 hours there just reading and...
Knowing that there are other people in the world with going through what you going through, that must have helped.
It did. It did. It helped, but I didn't have access to the internet all the time. Like now, if I was going through it now, I think I would probably handle it a bit better, because there is a lot of help out there available. There's a lot of people to talk to, and there's a lot of information. Back then, we didn't have internet at home, and it was one of those things that I would go to bookshops and try and buy books and get as much information as I could. But maybe I overloaded.
Yeah. I also know something about you, which is you're very energetic. You take on a lot of responsibility in very stressful situations. You're a radio producer. That's a very high-stress job, and I know that for a fact. You've also been in events management. I mean, events management. That's just amazing. I mean, I think that would bring on an anxiety attack in just about anyone, I think. But you weren't doing it at the time. But you're a very capable person. So I understand, too, that you had one of these attacks, and that evening you put on a full-on dinner party.
Yeah, well, I didn't plan it. It was one of the – we had friends coming over for dinner, and it was a case of pull yourself together and get it done. I don't even remember that night. I don't remember how sociable I was. I know that they did help me a little bit, but, yeah, I was sort of literally falling apart. And
yeah, how was it at its worst? It was that black cloud you were talking about.
Yeah, I couldn't leave the house. There was a couple of weeks I just didn't leave the house. Leaving the house was really, really difficult.
What did you tell your kids?
They were little. You know, they were little. And they've grown up with it now. I mean, they used to be toilet hunters for me. So they've sort of, and it's funny, the older one said not that long ago, goes, "Mum, you don't have to stop and go to the toilet much anymore." So they're kind of used to it.
So it wasn't just the anxiety, it was the fear of it happening again.
That's what anxiety is. Anxiety is the fear of having an anxiety attack. So you actually, you have this one incident, which then makes you think next time, oh, what if I have another one? And then you do, because you've made yourself slightly anxious. And then from then on, for me, it's always the fear that it's going to happen. Like, I'm quite okay now. On my way here, I was really, really nervous, but I had some things in place to make sure I'd be okay. But now I'm fine.
And we've pumped a sedative into the air conditioner too, which you're only just starting to notice, fortunately.
My palms aren't squirting anymore either.
Annie Roos is here. She's a radio producer and a blogger, and her blog is called Life and Dandelions. A fantastic title. So you managing this anxiety, you and your husband divorced.
Yep.
And meanwhile, you were tracking down your birth mother as an adoptive kid. What do you remember about finding – tell me about finding your birth mother.
Okay. That happened back – well, I was still married when that happened. She was actually there the night that my sister called, and we found out all the stuff about my father. So she was had been in my life since when I was pregnant with my oldest child. So and that was the reason that I wanted to find her. I didn't have any medical history, and that always bothered me. And now that I was going to be having children, I thought, you know, I really need to know if there's anything that I need to be aware of.
Was it hard to find her?
No. They recently changed the laws, so you could apply for your original birth certificate. So I applied for that, and I got my original one, which then had the name of my mother on it, and my birth name. And
when you met your birth mother? I mean, did you have that? I mean, a friend of mine who contacted her birth mother, astonished by the resemblance, same laugh.
Yeah, same laugh, definitely. Look, it was I had unreal expectations. I had always wanted this mother and this perfect family. And so when I met her, it was great and everything was great. And but I think everything I was going through with the anxiety and just a whole range of things, my expectations were that she would be this instant mother. And it just doesn't happen. I think mothers and children, the relationship grows. It's not, you don't instantly have a child and all of a sudden you're a mother. I think that relationship grows over time as you grow up together. So for me, I wanted things she couldn't give me, and the relationship didn't go particularly well. And we're in touch now. I'd like to think it will work out at some point, but it's as much as I wish it could be that, you know, she would be my mother, I don't have a mother. I suppose I don't deal with that level of family very well. I'm great being a mother and I understand that love, but I don't understand the love back from a child to a parent, and I think that's got a whole lot to do with my upbringing.
How did she respond when you said she was there when you were talking to your sister on the phone to find out about talking about your abusive adoptive father? How did she respond when she found out about that?
Not that well. She was a bit quite defensive about it, and
it's
No, and I understand that. I think she kind of didn't want to take on any blame. And look, I've had children, so giving up a child, I can only imagine the lifetime of difficulties dealing with that. So, again, it's a really hard situation. I'm sure she feels some guilt. I don't want her to. I don't feel any resentment. I'm actually happy with the life that I've had, despite...
Did she tell you why she gave you up for adoption?
Yes, she was... My father was her long-time boyfriend, and when she got pregnant, he left. He disappeared. And back then, good Catholic home in a nice suburb in Sydney. She didn't tell her parents for quite some time, so when they found out she was 7 months, they shipped her off down to Royal Women's Hospital at Paddington. They had an area under the hospital, sort of in the basement, and all the unmarried mothers went there that were adopting their babies, and they would look after the laundry and different tasks for the hospital while they waited to have their babies. So, and do you know that this...
That's extraordinary. I had no idea that was going on in Paddington.
Well, and the really scary thing was, she said to me that a lot of the women there that were pregnant as a result of rape or incest, uncles, grandfathers, brothers. And that really scared me, because I thought, if I had have even thought of that, I don't think I would have looked for her. So it was a really, really scary place to be. So she was there until she had me. And
she named you too.
She did. She named me. I actually like the story of I was named Janice. And what had happened was when she had me, the shift had changed, the nursing shift. So when the adopted mothers had the babies were taken straight away and the mothers never saw them. Because the shift had changed midway through her labour, then after I was born, the nurse on the shift gave me to her. And then...
That wasn't supposed to happen, though.
No. So then a little bit later, they snatched me away and took me away, and that was the last she saw of me. And there was a lady that was working in the hospital that had seen this happen. So she was talking to my mother, and she would go down and visit me all the time and go back and report on me. And I actually bought this in, because she actually stole the hospital photo that they had taken.
You just handed me a baby photo of you.
From the hospital.
Before you were given up for adoption.
Yeah. So this Janice lady actually stole it and gave it to her. So she always had a photo. She had that one and a smaller one. So she always had a photo of me in her wallet.
And she called you Janice after her.
And her name was Janice,
after that kindness.
Yeah. Yeah. So that was lovely. And look, it's... she's a lovely lady, my mum. And I would really love to just have that whole mother thing happening.
You were asking for her things of her she probably wasn't, she couldn't have given to you.
Oh, absolutely not. And I had no right to ask them. And even now I don't. I mean, we're still, she's a really lovely lady, and, she's in my life, and that's a good thing. And I think that's probably the best thing that it can be. So...
Janice, I called you Janice. I can't believe I did that. That's just your name sort of popped into my head then.
I can't believe you did that either.
That's really weird. Her name is actually Annie. Annie Roos is my guest, radio producer and vlogger. I can't believe I called you Janice then. It was the baby photo. That's what it was. How did you eventually get a treatment that worked for you, for your anxiety attacks?
Well, I was on and off antidepressants for a number of years. I'd come off them, I'd feel okay. One thing would happen and it would just take one attack and I'd be back in the depths of it again. It wasn't even a gradual lead up. So I would always go back to I have a fantastic psychiatrist who I've been seeing since 1999, and she's wonderful, and I do rely on her. Even though I don't suffer it as much now, she's still always there and I still visit her regularly. But she said to me one day, look, she said, you've got an illness. She said, there are diabetics out there, they take insulin. There's people with epilepsy take medication. People with high blood pressure take blood pressure medication. She said, you've got anxiety. That's your thing. It's no different to any of the other things that other people have. And you do need to take medication at times. She said, so don't feel that you failed. And I would always go there feeling like a failure every time it came back. Whereas now I've learnt that it's actually part of me. That's me. I have it, and it's never going to go away. And that's kind of made it a bit easier. The fear of it before was always there. So the fear of getting it, the fear of getting on medication, why can't I get rid of it? It's nothing I can get rid of. So I think accepting it.
I see what you mean now. So you came back to if you'd succumbed to an attack, and I'm using that, you know, in inverted commas, there was shame about that, and I'd failed.
Yeah.
It's like an alcoholic who'd had a drink.
Yeah, and I would spiral down into that, I'm here again, and I would kind of just lose the ability to stop it all happening.
Whereas, so you're trying to build a ladder out of it, but you can't.
You can't. And it's just here. It's always there. So I now, it kind of just lives alongside me. So I do a lot of things in my life maybe differently to you, because I know, you know, there's certain things, you know, if I have to be somewhere at 7 o'clock in the morning, I won't eat. I won't eat until after I've done whatever I have to do, because then I know I'll be quite okay in the car. But if I eat something, I know that there's a slight possibility I might need to stop.
Have you been given cognitive behaviour therapy, you know, which teaches you to break things down and helps you go through a simple series of steps?
Yeah, I haven't. That never appealed to me. Never, ever appealed to me.
Why not?
I don't know. I would read about it, and it just didn't do anything. But I did read about hypnosis, and that resonated with me. I thought, you know what, maybe that's what I'll do. So a number of years ago, I went along and had some hypnosis. I researched, you know, where to go, and was a bit scared. I didn't want to go somewhere and come out and be quacking like a duck every time I heard a song or something.
Stage magician wouldn't have been good.
Yeah. So anyway, this guy was fantastic. He would take me back to a place that I really like and get me into that, thinking about that, and then he would take me back to a place I had an anxiety attack, and this would go on, and I don't really remember everything that happened in the sessions. He gave me a CD to listen to at night. I have no idea what he says. I've never heard it, because I put it on and I'd wake up at the end, and obviously whatever it was has given me more of an ability to slow it down. So if I feel an attack coming on, like when I was in my friend's car recently, I can pull back a bit, whereas I didn't have the ability to do that before.
What do you do when you pull back? Tell me how you do it.
I start
this
just...
This is just for you. This is something that won't necessarily work for everyone, but it works for you.
I start just getting involved with what's happening around me. So I'll talk to the person I'm sitting next to, or her children were in the back, so I just started turning around and talking to them. And at the minute my mind is off it, I can have the melted contents of my stomach, but if I turn my mind off it, it goes away.
Oh, so you don't meditate. I was thinking you were going to say, well, I take myself to a lush waterfall.
I
recline beside the waterfall. No, you can talk to the kids.
I just find something to do with my mind so it stops thinking about, because it's the thinking that takes me there. It's the, okay, I'm going to have a panic. Oh, my God, where's the toilet? And I start looking and I start hyperventilating and, oh, how am I going to be able to stop? Oh, my God, there's red lights here and there's too many cars and she's not going to be able to pull over. And this mental chatting goes on.
So you just, I don't know, what, drown it out with the kind of mundane, quotidian sort of nonsense of day-to-day life?
I kind of just say, look,
chat.
Be quiet. I can't talk to you right now, and I just talk to someone else. So that's kind of how I've done it. Look, I don't think there is any one, there's no cure, there's no one way that works, and I think for me there's a whole number of ways depending on
who
the day,
mm.
where I am, Yeah.
And that's the right for the person you are, the circumstances
that's
you're
right.
in, the environment
that's right.
you're in.
All, and being a woman too, different hormonal cycles play a really big part. I won't put myself in a position anywhere at that really...
interesting time.
Yes, because I'm much more... My levels of anxiety are much more heightened then. So.
And now you've got a fiancé.
I do.
And you've got a new job in radio. Congratulations.
Thank you.
It's a wonderful business to be in. High stress. And I met you once at an event where you were the event manager. What?
And I've done some emceeing for those same events as well.
Emceeing? Why are you doing that instead of, for instance, I don't know, working in a meditation firm? why are you doing these incredibly busy, high-stress jobs?
I think I like to just push myself out there. I don't think about it at the time, but then I sort of suddenly go, oh, my God, what am I doing? Because I keep doing these things that I keep putting myself out there, and I don't know why. Maybe it's just a subconscious need to prove that, you know, I'm not going to let it beat me.
Do you think the fact that you've got an event on, or for example, an event management, and there's an elephant that's got to be brought on stage, the MC's, you know, having a meltdown or something, and you've got to take care of all these things. There's just too much to be getting on with to have that kind of chit-chat.
I think you're right. Yeah. The things that I do require, it's the lead-up that's very stressful. Like, you know, being an MC, it's that morning before. I mean, you know, I'm almost melting down by that. But once I get up on the stage and I start, it's all go, go, go. With work, same with everything that I do. So,
and here's the thing that I read your blog this morning, and the thing that made me laugh is that after 12 years of experiencing anxiety attacks in cars, you've been teaching your teenage sons to drive.
Yes.
Are you all right?
No. Actually, I took one out yesterday morning and we had the biggest fight at the end. He says, I'm never getting in the car with you again. It's crazy.
So when you're like, oh my God, we're going to die.
I wasn't with the older one. The younger one has a sort of no ability to do three things at once or two things at once. So, oh, look. He'll be getting the gears right and I'll be going, watch out, there's a car, and I'll be sort of screaming and he's like, Mum, stop screaming. It's a nightmare.
Well, if they can cope with that high-stress situation, they'll be fine in peak traffic.
They will.
You got advice to someone listening to this that gets the odd anxiety attack?
Look.
I'll preface it by saying you're not a medical expert.
No, not at all.
Those things, but just someone who knows what it is to live with it.
Just accept it. Accept it, live with it. And find your own place, your own way to deal with it, you know.
Annie, you're a fantastic guest. I've loved having you on the program today.
Oh, thank you. I've loved being here.
Thank you so much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast of Conversations with Richard Feidler. For more information and interviews, visit abc.net.au/conversations.